I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Cory Doctorow joins me now. He has just published his latest novel, Walkaway. It is described as an epic tale of revolution, love, post-scarcity, and the end of death. I'll get him to tell us about this book, which has already gotten terrific notices. In the book, we see the three main characters walk away from the clutches of a broken-down modern society. It takes place sometime in the very near future, where wealth is concentrated and in the hands of the very few, and the less fortunate scrape by in desolate cities that have been gutted by industrial flight. Cory Doctorow is co-editor of Boing Boing and a columnist for The Guardian, Publishers Weekly, and Locus. His previous books include the New York Times bestseller Little Brother, as well as many award-winning novels and works of nonfiction. Visit craphound.com for more information. The Twitter handle is at Doctorow. Cory will be in Vancouver as part of a special event with the Vancouver Writers' Fest tonight, the 17th of May. That's at SFU Woodwards, where Cory will be in conversation with her old friend Sean Cranberry. Go to writersfest.bc.ca for tickets and information. Walkaway is published by Tor Books. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Cory Doctorow. Mr. Doctorow, good morning.
Oh, good morning. It's nice to talk to you.
It's nice to talk to you, too. Where are you today?
Oh, I'm speaking to you from Seattle, Washington,
yeah.
Where I had a wonderful event with Neal Stephenson, another great science fiction writer, at a theater here. So one of the last stops on this leg of my tour.
Yeah, and so I was just talking to you before we started about how you get to see all these marvelous independent bookstores throughout the United States on this tour. I mean, that must be something enjoyable. I mean, as someone who loves books, it must be fun.
Yeah, I'm a recovering bookseller. You know, I worked at stores in Toronto for years and years, and there's just something really deeply comforting to me about being in a good indie bookstore and kind of wandering the shelves and running my fingers along the spines.
Yeah, this book, Walkaway, has gotten a lot of great notices, and a lot of the reviewers are talking about how good this book is in terms of capturing the fears that a lot of people have about the future, and not just the future, but even the present. How do you write that? I mean, do you foresee that? Do you write out of fear, say?
Well, I certainly write to kind of reflect my both my fears and my aspirations. You know, I reject the idea that we can say that technology is good or bad, and really embrace the idea that technology requires that we think about how to use it for good, or else we'll do bad with it. There's a wonderful law review paper written by a cyberlearn named Michael Weinberg about 3D printing and copyright and patents. And the title really sums it up, which is, this will all be so great if we don't F it up. And, you know, if I have a philosophy, it's that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Walkaway is in part a warning about just how bad things can get if our computers and networks are used as tools of control and coercion. But just how amazing it is to contemplate a world in which computers are used to liberate us from hierarchy, from scarcity, to allow us to work together without having to agree on everything, so that we can share more accomplishment without having to kick people out of our tent. You know, that is, to me, like an amazing utopian vision. And so, you know, I call it, the original title for the book was Utopia, and I call it like an optimistic disaster novel, because it shows both sides of that technology being used in ways that I find really frightening, and then technology being used to resist that as well.
But don't you think if you were a betting person, say that technology will be used for the bad ways rather than the good ways? I mean, just looking at the people around us, say.
Well, I think you've got an or where you want an and. Technology is clearly used in both ways. I am a science fiction writer, which means that I more than anyone know that science fiction writers have no business predicting the future. Which is good news, because if the future were predictable, then there would be no reason to get out of bed.
Yeah.
I think that the future is contestable, that the future depends on what we do. And I further think that we are prone as a species to something called the availability heuristic, an idea from behavioral economics, which is the idea that, like, things that we can imagine more readily, we overestimate the probability of. So we spend a lot of time worrying about, like, stranger danger and not a lot of time worrying about our kids eating spoiled food, despite the fact that listeria is a much more common killer than strangers.
Yeah.
And, you know, and what that means is that we end up producing really bad, stilted policy outcomes. We don't have a much-needed war on inadequate refrigeration, and we've got a really significant war on largely imaginary stranger danger. And figuring out or writing stories that help people call to mind futures in which good things are used well, in which technology is used to resist authoritarianism and to enable people to be more collaborative and to be more cooperative and to create broadly shared prosperity, I think actually impacts what we do. I think it makes it easier to call to mind the possibility that that will happen. You know, when you say, if you were a betting man, which side would you bet on? I don't think that any of us can pretend to know the future. And so what you're really asking is, which stories did you find easiest to believe in? Mm. And changing which story we find easiest to believe in changes which story we end up living.
So because we look at science fiction and we see what dystopia is for a lot of authors, and we sort of think it's bad or it scares us. You remain very hopeful as you're writing, right? Especially this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that it's an indictment of hopefulness to believe that we'll have a future with disasters in it, right? To plan a future in which nothing bad ever happens, not hopeful. It's foolish. You know, engineers who design systems on the assumption that nothing will ever go wrong build the Titanic, right? The hopeful thing to believe is that you can build a system that fails gracefully when the inevitable failure comes, that you can plan to have a system that coasts to a gentle stop instead of exploding in a horrific fireball. Yeah. And that requires real design thinking. It requires that you apply yourself to imagining what might go wrong and to planning not for the system to overcome it, but for people to be able to put things to right. And in that regard, I'm very hopeful.
Now these three main characters in Walk Away, what are they seeing in their own lives and each other that they decide to walk away from it all? I mean, what's happening in the world that's surrounding them, the people around them, say?
Sure. Well, you know, they're inhabiting a world in which the super rich have gotten so rich that all policy outcomes are really dictated by their needs and by what makes them happy, comfortable, and to feel good in their lives. And that meant that a greater and greater proportion of the rest of the world has become superfluous, kind of surplus to requirement. The robots just don't need that many humans to supervise them, and the humans who do supervise them just don't need that many unemployed humans kicking around to scare them into continuing to work for subsistence wages rather than taking their risk in the job market. And so these three people, two slightly older men and a younger woman whose father is among the super rich, they look around and decide that they're going to throw their lot in with anything but this, that they're going to vote for effectively for none of the above, and see if they can find a way to join this existing kind of bohemian technological culture that exists on the fringes of society and the blighted wastelands of post-industrial civilization, where they're picking up the waste material exhausted by manufacturing and repurposing it to create these fantastic, luxurious living conditions that they're prepared to abandon at the drop of a hat. As soon as one of the rich weirdos shows up and says, "That's my garbage and my dirt you're living on," they say, "Well, that's all right. We'll just go find some different garbage and some different dirt and do it again, because we have the technology and the tools. That means that every time we do it, it gets better, and it just isn't that much work to do it. And we reject you and all your premises." And that vision is so seductive to them that they walk away to do it, and they find in it something better than they expected, but also very different from what they expected. They find in it something that's worth fighting for.
And so it's a person who creates these characters and cultivates the story around them that's throughout the book. As for the characters themselves, I mean, are there little bits of you in them?
Well, you know, there's this funny conceit in novel writing that we can know what another person is thinking. You know, in some respect, all novels are science fiction because they all pretend that telepathy is possible. No human being in the entire history of the planet ever knew what anyone else was thinking.
Yeah.
And yet, all novels are about this human interiority. And given that each writer only has one interior to draw on, their own, all characters necessarily reflect their own thinking. Now, that's not to say that I'm not trying to imagine what another person might be doing, but that imagining will always be imperfect. That imagining is always filtered through my own lens. So, again, in the spirit of, like, confronting one's own self-serving rationale, I know that when I write these other characters, that I'm really just reflecting aspects of myself.
And so are they the worst parts of, say, your imagination in terms of the fears that you have?
Well, I think that they're a kind of mix. You know, there's this thing that happens when you start writing a novel where it's almost embarrassing. It's like you're putting on a puppet show for yourself. But as you keep writing, I think what happens is the part of your mind that tries to model other people to figure out whether you can trust them and whether they're competent and whether they're nice or good, that part of your mind, being very naive and on very automatic, just starts to build models of these people you're explicitly inventing. And it loses track of the fact that these are imaginary people. And it starts to make predictions about what these people would and wouldn't do in these situations. And you start to get into this very automatic process where instead of rationally thinking through what these characters might do, you're accessing a kind of intuitive sense of it. It's like the difference between learning a new dance and having to focus on each step, and then acquiring fluency with the dance and having the steps take care of themselves and being able to kind of improvise and play with it, because the part of your brain that does things unconsciously is now handling a lot of the heavy lifting for you.
See, as someone who doesn't write, and I'm sure people listening to us who don't write hear about the process that writers go through to create their characters, to write the story that they're doing, it seems like fascinating fun, but I mean, as a writer, I mean it is work. It is it's probably terrifying at the same time. Is it for you?
You know, I made a conscious choice in my life to make it less terrifying, which has also made it less fun. You know, like a lot of writers, I think probably like most writers, when I started writing, I wrote when I was inspired. I was a young person, and every now and again, an idea for a fun story would come into my head, and it would be kind of like sinking into a warm bath. And when I decided that this is what I wanted to do for a living and for a vocation, I realized that waiting for inspiration to strike was no way to go about writing, no way to go about doing something that was so key to one's identity. I mean, there are surgeons who wake up not wanting to take out your gallbladder, and there are, you know, garbage men who wake up not wanting to empty out your trash, mm-hmm. but they go on and do it. No one's ever heard of surgeon's block. And at a certain point, I recognized that although there were days when I felt very inspired and felt like every word I wrote was fantastic, and days when I felt like every word I wrote was garbage, that 6 months later, I couldn't tell which days were which. Mm. And that very rational, deliberate realization that how I felt about my writing was not related to what I was writing, but rather to things like my stress levels and my blood sugar and, you know, my endocrine system, that realization let me operationalize writing. So it's just a thing I do every day, inspiration or no. And it means that I don't have the same highs. I don't have those heroic nights where I pull an all-nighter and write 10,000 words in a kind of white-hot blaze, but I also don't have those long, miserable, terrifying periods where I just can't feel like I can get the magic to happen, where the words never seem to come. Instead, I sit down, and whether or not it feels like the right words are coming out, I write the words. And then later on, I go back and I fix them. And so I don't get the highs, but I also don't get the lows.
So how do you write? Do you write on a computer? Do you write longhand?
Oh, no, I've always written on a computer. My dad was a computer science teacher, and, you know, in 1977, he brought home a teletype terminal from OISE, the teacher's college in Toronto, and I started learning to type, and I just never learned to write. write longhand properly. I still can't read my handwriting. So, yeah, no, I just pull out my laptop and write my, these days I'm working on a third little brother novel, and I'm working at the rate of a page a day, which is not much, but I have a lot of else going on, and it's still a novel a year. And I sit down and I write my page no matter what, no matter whether that's, you know, tapping out a few words by opening up my laptop on the on an escalator handrail while I'm moving through an airport, or whether that's sitting in my hotel room, or whether that's being on a plane and scrunched up and writing. I write my words and then I'm done.
Yeah. The other thing I was wondering about, because I've seen you do other shows on this book tour and other interviews, and if you're on the technology thing, talking to them from your house, say, or your office, I notice a lot of books. How many books do you have?
Many thousands, but many thousands fewer than I once had. I've moved continents rather a lot. Yeah. I lived in Europe twice in the last 15 years, moving to America in between for a while, and I moved from Toronto to the States 15, 20 years ago. And so I've left a lot of books behind as I moved around. We're trying to buy a house in Los Angeles now, and if we do, I'm going to take all the books that are in a storage locker in Wales, where storage is much cheaper than it is in London, and we're going to ship them over. And then finally, I think, and for the last time, I'll be able to marry all of my books together, and they won't be separated again, and then it'll probably be 10,000 or so.
Yeah, I've got a few thousand myself, and I don't know what I'd do without them, and I'm listening to you and hearing you separated from them, I do cringe a little bit.
You know, I spend so little time at home these days that it hardly matters.
Yeah.
I've been on the road a lot since we moved over. I have this activist life where I'm campaigning for more privacy and less surveillance on the Internet, more free speech on the Internet. That keeps me on the road. And then I have the books that I write. And between those two, and publicity tours for the latter, and activist work on the former, I'm on the road really rather a lot. And so I, as much as I miss my books, it's not like I get to commune with them very much. Again, it's a kind of stoic thing where realizing that the comfort and pleasure that I get from my books really just only happens in my head. Mm-hmm. And just knowing that I've read them and being able to access what they give me intellectually and emotionally, I can tell myself that that's enough, and it can be.
Yeah, I know someone who had to spend some time in prison, and one of the things that their wife did for them was to send them photographs of his book collection, and he said that in prison it helped them a great deal get through the days just looking at them on the shelf like that.
Yeah, I just keynoted at the Michigan Library Association, and I met a Michigan prison librarian. And her very eloquent description of the role that books can play in prisoners' lives was so moving, and I've returned to it many times in the last few weeks since we had that conversation.
Yeah.
I've sent books to people in prison. I sent books to Chelsea Manning and to Peter Sunda from the Pirate Bay, and I often think about what it must be like to be there and be separated from that intellectual life.
Yeah. Well, what is the relationship between morality and technology? I mean, I've been thinking about this as I've been preparing for our chat the last day or two, because I tend to think that with the ubiquity of technology in our lives, that most people, I don't know, they seem less moral, and it's a terrible judgment to make from where I sit. But I mean, do you think there's a relationship there?
Well, I think that technology can run ahead of our norms and can make it hard to figure out exactly what kind of thing you're doing when you do a thing. You know, the advent of the telescope was not accompanied by the advent of everybody looking through everyone else's bedroom windows. We never said, well, what were you thinking living on the 40th floor without curtains and then, you know, standing, passing in front of your window? You should have known that now that we have telescopes, people would be looking in your bedroom window. We were able to promulgate a social norm that said looking through people's bedroom windows with telescopes makes you a creep. And it's not that no one ever does it, but when they get caught, sometimes they're breaking the law, and always they're breaking the norms. They're subject to social punishments. And yet we have this ability to spy on people as they use networks. And we've decided that just using the network constitutes a kind of consent, like you should have known. And I think gradually we're coming to understand that not only do people not know or not understand, but that when they do understand, they try to take countermeasures. And that oftentimes the people who say, well, the fact that you took no countermeasures to stop me from spying on you means that you consented, also say that as soon as you start taking that countermeasure, that you're stealing free newspapers because you're ad blocking, or you're doing something politically suspect because you're using an anonymity tool that the RCMP or CSIS can't access. And what you realize when that discussion takes place is that the people who are advocating for total surveillance, they are starting from the premise that their lives would be easier if surveillance were total, and then backforming from it a kind of moral justification for it. And no matter what you do, they'll always find the justification. And that you're not really having an honest discussion about the morality of using networks to spy on people. What's really happening is you are engaged in a kind of rationalization with someone who is intellectually dishonest and whose only ethic starts and ends with the idea that your privacy matters less than them enriching themselves or having an easier time doing their job.
Yeah. You're on your way to Vancouver to speak here. I'm talking to you the day before, so by the time this is up on my website, it'll be tonight. Do you like coming out here?
I love Vancouver. You know, one of the wonderful things about being an expatriate from Canada is that you no longer have to choose a side in the great Toronto-Vancouver war. You can become a Canadian instead of a Torontonian, which is really great. And you know, some of my favorite people live in Vancouver, and on a good trip, I get to socialize with some or all of them. And the city is so beautiful, and so much of the things that I love are foregrounded there, from the access to nature to the spectacular food and the wonderful architecture. And I've been very heartened by the fact that Vancouver seems to be the first major city in the world that has been in the grips of a destructive property bubble to recognize that housing is shelter first and an asset second, and that if you don't take care of it as shelter first, that its value as an asset plummets, because, of course, what's the point of speculating on real estate in a city where no one can afford to live? At that point, these things become tulip bulbs, not homes. And I've been very heartened to watch Vancouver taking active measures to deal with its housing crisis.
Yeah, it seems though that it's unwinnable at times. That there are more people that don't see it that way than do. I mean, how do you see our future?
Well, you know, attitudes change. Yeah. Our attitudes change. You know, in living memory, markets were things that you went to once every 2 weeks, and not a moral philosophy or a central organizing principle. And there was a kind of vast psychological project to change how people perceive markets. And you know, I don't think it was for the best. I think we well overshot any reasonable discussion of how and when markets should be deployed. But I'm in awe of the success of the project. You know, who would have thought in the early years of Mulroney and Thatcher and Pinochet and Reagan that market logic could come to be so all-consuming that literally turning a city into a bunch of safe deposit boxes in the sky would be considered morally right, because if you can afford to do it, why shouldn't you be allowed to do it? That's an amazing thing. But the fact that things change means that they can change again.
Yeah.
You know, we tend to overestimate the immutability of things that have actually only come into being pretty recently. We tend to think that we are living in the terminal state, that the ideas changed and changed and changed and then arrived where we are, and now they're done. But it's far more likely, statistically, that we are living in a moment that will pass than a moment that will be eternal.
I've enjoyed our chat today, and I wish you safe travels as you make your way up here, and I know you'll get a good crowd because you've got a lot of fans up here. I'm looking forward to reading this book.
Well, thank you. It was very mutual. I really enjoyed chatting with you as well.
The book is called Walk Away, Tor Books is its publisher. Its author, Cory Doctorow, joined me on the line from Seattle and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.